So, to finish up the last lecture, first, on the website, if you go to the slide, you'll see this little panel, and you can click on this link on the slide. If you open the slides for the class and there's any web link, like for the little clips I showed, you can just click on the slide, and it will take you to the web link. This is a link to a film. In the last couple of times I've taught the class, we had a film series that went once a week on Monday nights. Joel Rogers and I decided not to do it this year, even though I really like the documentary films. We got lots of complaints from students about having to go to something outside of class on a regular basis. My sense was about half the class thought it was fantastic and half the class found it a burden. So we decided this year not to do it. I'm not sure that was on balance, the right decision. These documentary films really did add a dimension to many of the topics that we're covering. And this film in particular, I think, is a good one to see. And you can, since it's online, you can stream it, you can watch it yourself. It's a detailed account of the L.A. story that was in the Who Framed Roger Rabbit clips that we saw, about the strategies of General Motors to destroy public transportation in order to create an environment in which it was rational for people to choose cars. And it's just it's a really good story. There's this great scene at the end when, after all the trolley tracks were pulled up in Los Angeles, they had all these trolley cars that they couldn't use, and they had a bonfire. And there's this fantastic series, episode in the film of just watching all the trolley cars of Los Angeles burning. It's a kind of nightmare vision for what a rational, well-ordered, at least in my view, of what a rational, well-ordered public transportation should be like. Let's burn all the public transportation. It goes up in flames and smoke. That, in a way, symbolizes the key point of having this section of the class, this particular topic, on public transportation. It is an important topic in its own right, but it also really symbolizes this very peculiar problem in any complex society in which markets play a big role. And that's a big challenge for anyone who puts all their faith in the market as a way of providing choices for people. So this is really the way to think about it. This is the kind of big take-home message of this topic. The market is defended, and for good reason, as a way of organizing how people acquire the things they consume, which gives them choice. Remember the idea of consumer sovereignty? It's ultimately the preferences of consumers, what they want to buy, that determines what gets produced. And that's this ideal of the perfect market that registers all of your preferences. Because you decide not to buy some things, then you're punishing that producer, and you choose to buy other things, you're rewarding them. And this system of rewards and punishments that you, the consumer, do through your choices signals to producers what to produce. The premise of that idea that the market properly registers all of your preferences, the premise of that is that the array of choices put on the table from which you choose is also determined by your preferences. So if you have behind the scenes powerful actors that are deciding what you can or cannot choose, then you have a fundamental violation of the core principle that the market efficiently translates preferences into outcomes. And that's what's shown in this very dramatic way in the Los Angeles case. A powerful actor, General Motors, decided to remove from the choice possibilities of the residents of Los Angeles the possibility of choosing the red car over private cars, the trolley system over private cars. So that kind of environment of choice is not the result of choice, of the choice of consumers. That's really clear in public transportation, but of course lots of other areas of consumer choice are also structured by the way power operates in the background. Now, in the case of public transportation, the only way for public transportation to be a private choice, that is for you to be able to say, should I buy a second car for my family or should we use public transportation? The only way for that option to be on the table for your individual choice is if we collectively make a choice to provide public transportation. Because you can't individually make that choice. It has to be a collective choice. And the only way to make a coherent collective choice is really to have it be done through democratic institutions. That's why public transportation has to be produced publicly. It can't just be produced by private entrepreneurs producing public transportation. It has to be produced through collective decisions to allocate resources to this purpose. And then make the individual choices that people make have the full array of possibilities. So that's the big punchline, the take-home message. I'm doing my thing of repeating probably too many times one point. The big take-home message is that while consumers make choices in a market, they don't choose the conditions of their own choices in many contexts. They don't choose the array of choices available. And sometimes it's crucial that the excluded possibilities are excluded by the exercise of power in the background. And that's why we need public choice, not just private choice, in shaping what markets provide. Just to finish up the specifics of the transportation lecture itself, I was just beginning to talk about solutions to the problem of public transportation. If it does provide these public goods, if it does provide a more efficient way of organizing an overall urban transportation system to have a mix of public and private transportation options, with good public transportation options as one of the choices people can make, what are the ways in which we could do this? What are the solutions to the transportation dilemmas in the American economy? And the first and simplest thing I pointed out was no free parking. Free parking is an illusion. It's always paid for. And it has the effect of being a big subsidy for private transportation. So if we want to put public and private transportation on an even footing so that when people make their choices, they're making them on the basis of weighing the costs and benefits, one thing to do is to increase the costs of private transportation by having people pay the true costs of using private transportation. And the true costs of that decision includes the costs of parking. So parking shouldn't be free. We need to build infrastructure for transportation alternatives. Bike paths and rapid transit would be clear examples. Madison is rated either number one or two. We're in a competition with Portland. Is anybody from Portland here? Portland, Oregon. So. Madison and Portland, various bike magazines rate Madison and Portland number one or number two as bike-friendly cities. I consider it a big accomplishment that in a cold climate with snow in the winter, Madison is even a contender for a bike-friendly city. It's because the bike paths, the urban bike paths, get plowed in Madison. Most cities that have bike paths in cold climates don't plow their bike paths. Well, in Madison, you can reliably ride bikes all winter long. I ride my bike all winter long. For those of you who are hearty and hardy and like to have a certain challenge in January, I recommend that you get studded snow tires for your bicycles. You can get bike tires with little cleats in them, and it enables you to ride bikes all winter long. At my age, I consider this a really cheap way for people to think I'm tough, because it's actually no big deal to ride my bike into work. I think I'm cold less of the time than if I were to walk to to my car, drive to the parking lot, and then have to walk in the cold to my office. This way, I warm up pretty quickly. My problem when I bike in January is that I overheat, not that I'm cold. So any rate, as a little personal aside, build infrastructure for alternatives. Increase the residential density within cities. widespread, dispersed, low-density suburbanization creates public transportation problems. So high-density cities find it much more efficient to have public transportation than very low-density cities. And that's one of the problems in Los Angeles, of course, is that land in the past, when the city was being built, was so cheap, and there was so much unoccupied land in the environment of the city, that it expanded outwards rather than inwards in terms of density. The full price of driving should be reflected in the price of gas. Gasoline is what enables people to drive their cars. If we want people, when they make the choice to drive their car, to be able to fully appreciate all of the costs involved in driving their cars, the costs of street repairs, the costs of air pollution, all the costs involved in driving cars, it should be reflected in their choice to drive their car. And the easiest way to do that is through a gasoline tax. The United States has the lowest gasoline taxes of any of the developed countries in the world. If you look at this chart, the light gray area indicates the price of a gallon of gas. I don't remember the date for this. This is probably, it might say it in the book where this chart appears, sometime in the last 8 or 10 years. You can see that the actual price of the raw material doesn't vary that much across countries. You know, the price of a gallon of gas to the gas company in the United States and in the United Kingdom are roughly the same. But there's a huge difference in the price of gas at the pump, and that's because gasoline taxes are vastly higher in other countries. And the reason that the justification in at least many of these countries for having high gasoline taxes is precisely that people who drive cars should pay the full cost of driving their cars, the full costs to the public of driving their cars. And the gas tax then, being much larger, enables gasoline taxes to be used to build public infrastructure for non-automobile transportation. One should not think of that. So one way of looking at that is that car drivers are subsidizing public transportation. The word subsidy is actually not accurate there. What's happening, the way to think about it is, car drivers are paying the full costs of driving their car. And by virtue of that, there's more resources available to allocate to public transportation. So it does take the form of a transfer from the car driver to the public transportation user. Yes, it's true. That's what it looks like. But they're actually, this is just a way to get them both in equilibrium with respect to what it truly costs to use those services. High gas taxes in the United States are justified even if you're an anti-tax person. So a free market defender should be in favor of high taxes on gas. If they're not, they're not being consistent. I mean, that might seem weird, right? How can you be against taxes in principle but be in favor of high gasoline taxes? Well, the reason is if you're a real defender of the market, what you want is market choices to reflect the true costs of using things, of consuming particular things. That's what markets are good at. And when they're bad at it, the only way you can make them good at it is to introduce some device that makes people experience the true costs of purchasing something, in this case gasoline, and that's what the tax does. And that tax then can be used to enable people to use alternatives also reflecting their true costs. The true costs of public transportation should be, for the consumer, much lower than they are. And this is the fifth aspect of the solution. We should fully recognize the value of positive externalities in the price of public transit tickets. And I think that perhaps, this is hard to really calculate, but I think perhaps the rational price level for public transportation tickets should be zero. Basically, public transportation should be free transportation. We should encourage people to use it to the max, and that would be the most efficient use. Now, this is a complicated issue, and I know that it'll be confusing to some people, just because it's the first time you may have kind of heard this kind of reasoning. So I just want to go briefly through some steps. Why is it that the positive externalities of public transportation should be reflected in lower ticket prices? Positive externalities should be reflected in lower prices to the consumers. Negative externalities should be reflected in higher prices. So for the automobile case, there's lots of negative externalities from driving cars. Streets have to be repaired more frequently, for example. That's a side effect of driving cars. And so we want to make the cost of driving cars higher to the consumer in order to pay for those negative externalities. And the way to do that is through a gas tax. So negative externalities should make things more expensive. And when they don't, it's inefficient. It should make them more expensive. If there's lots of positive externalities, then it should be reflected in lower prices. So here's the reasoning. Suppose that the direct average cost of a ride is $3. So if you look at the total number of riders and the total cost of providing the service and divide them up, you get $3 a ride as the total direct costs. And suppose there is some kind of negative externality of taking a ride. And let's say the value of that negative externality is $1 a ride. What that means is that the true costs of every ride is $4, not $3. And people should be charged $4 a ride, because then what they're being charged covers the full cost of providing that service. That's if there's a negative externality. That's kind of like the automobile case, where you use a gas tax as a way of imposing that cost on the user. That's the first kind of case. Now let's look at the second kind of case. Suppose the direct cost of a ride, on average, is again $3. Take all the riders that use the service and divide, have them, the numerator and the denominator is the total cost of providing the service, and it comes out to $3 a ride. But suppose that there's a positive externality. Having people ride public transportation means you don't have to repair the streets so often. Having people ride public transportation means that medical costs for asthma go down. Having people ride public transportation reduces congestion, so there's fewer hours lost commuting for those people who do drive, and so on. Let's suppose that all of those positive externalities together come to $1 a ride. Then the true cost for the rider is only $2. So the ticket price should only be $2. The ticket price should only be $2, not $3. Now, of course, and here's the kind of interesting little ironies that get kicked in. If you charged only $2, then more people would use public transportation. So the cost, the average cost per person would go down. There would still be the $1 per person positive externality. So if you actually charged people $2, then you should maybe only charge them $1.50. You can see how if lowering the price increases ridership, it might mean that the price should even be lower. Now, the transit company has spent $3 per rider in direct costs to pay for the ride. That's what the public transportation company has done. That's how we calculated that $3. If they only collect $2 a ride, they're going to go broke, right? They're going to have a deficit. The tickets are not going to cover their direct costs. They've spent on tracks or on buses and trains, on conductors, on labor costs, on cleaning things up. All of their costs together average out to $3 a ride. They're only collecting $2 a ride because that's the proper cost, taking into account that positive externality. Well, they're going to lose $1 a ride with respect to the cost they have to cover. The only way to deal with that is to give them what we call a subsidy. That is, we have to publicly subsidize through some mechanism public transportation in order for it to be efficient. Now, this means the following, and this is, again, this is a take-home message. You know, you don't understand it, then ask your TAs or ask me about it. When public transportation systems are told, you have to cover all the costs through your tickets, They are being told to be inefficient. That's not efficient. That's inefficient. If they are forced to charge $3 a ride in order to cover their costs, they're being forced to be inefficient. To be efficient, they should only, in this little example, only be charging $2 a ride, because that reflects the positive externalities in the world. The tax subsidies to public transportation is what makes them economically efficient. It pays them for the true costs of running a public transportation system, which is $3 direct costs and minus $1 of positive externalities per ride. So it should not be called, our language doesn't have the right words. We call it a subsidy. Subsidies make it seem like somehow they can't do it themselves, and so we have to pay for it through this subsidy. It makes it seem like it's a reflection of how inefficient they are. Subsidies should not be, in this case, should not be thought of as that way. The subsidy is the collective payment by the whole community in order for the efficient, for the service in question, to function efficiently. Now, my hunch is, it's very hard to get real data to support this. My hunch is that if you really cashed out all the positive benefits of public transportation, of a really good, efficient, pleasant public transportation system that many, many people would use, if you cashed out all the positive effects, probably the best price per ticket would be zero. That is, they should be fully subsidized by the public, not just partially subsidized. And remember that list of positive externalities that I talked about. One of the really important ones is, how easy is it for people to get to their jobs who cannot afford cars? And one of the issues around poverty in the United States, only one, but not a trivial one, is that the jobs for people are not located in the places where they live. And that's because the cost of housing where the jobs are too high for poor people to live there. And so they have to live distant from where the jobs are. And then the cost of getting from where they live to where they work, costs in both time and financial resources, if they're forced to have cars, are too great for them to get to those jobs. That's why there is often a situation where there's a surplus of unemployed people in the central cities and job vacancies in the suburbs that those people could fill, but they can't get to the jobs and they can't afford to live in the suburbs. Well, a good, efficient, cheap, or free public transportation makes that possible, and that saves on all sorts of other social costs. I think public transportation should probably be free, but that's a debatable issue. One other thing to add, just so you know, it costs public transportation systems something to actually collect fares. Now, the technologies of fare collection have gotten cheaper, with renewable cards and things like that. It used to be that you actually paid cash every time you entered a public transportation. But still, there's quite a bit of cost involved in simply the act of collecting money from people. You have to have cash machines. You have to have ticket dispensing machines. You have to have guards to prevent people entering subway stations. You have to have all sorts. You have to have accountants to count, to take care of the money, security guards to transport it. You have all these extra costs simply because you're gathering fares. I was told, and this is an example of a statistic which I do not have a source for, so it's something that I was told in a conversation with somebody who works on public transportation, that about 25% of the cost of most rides is simply because people have to pay for them. Somewhere around 25%. So if you have a $2 subway fare in New York City, roughly 50 cents of it goes to simply collecting fares. Now, that's what's called a deadweight loss, right? That expenditure in the subway system in no way improves or contributes to the actual running of the subway. And that's another reason why I think it should be free. If it's free, you can get rid of all that apparatus. You don't need turnstiles. You can just open up the subways, and people just walk on and off. That's not going to happen anytime soon, but I think it's ultimately the way an efficient public transportation system would operate. Well, this is just the summary, the big take-home message. It'll be on the slides, so if you look at the slides, you can constantly remind yourself of the big take-home message for our session on public transportation.